I'm Marty Moscoway, and welcome to Radio Times. The humanitarian crisis in Ukraine grows more critical as the Russian military digs deeper into the country, leaving death, misery, and destruction in its path. The UN estimates that more than a million refugees have fled to neighboring countries by any means necessary. And who hasn't seen the heartbreaking photos and footage of mostly women and children in the bitter cold, walking and waiting for entry into Hungary or Slovakia, Poland, and other European safe havens. And it seems that a deteriorating situation is only going to get worse. Joining us from Poland is freelance journalist Agnieszka Pikulicka-Lijewska, and she's been covering the refugee crisis for Al Jazeera. Thanks for joining us on Radio Times today.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. You have been along the Ukrainian border at some of these, if I can call them, sort of welcoming centers for Ukrainian refugees. What kind of services are being offered?
Well, any kind of services are being offered. The biggest problem is that the majority of service provided is by individuals, Polish people who just decided to support the Ukrainian neighbors fleeing the war. There is still a proper humanitarian infrastructure to be established at the borders. Also, the governments, local governments, should be helping much more, because the existing aid, the existing humanitarian assistance is definitely not enough. But across the border, at many different border crossings, we can see hundreds of Polish people, average citizens, offering free rides to Ukrainians to any place in Poland, also offering a place to stay, food, clothes, diapers, basically anything that that the people crossing the border might need.
And are you seeing people, refugees, arriving all day, every day, or do they come in kind of fits and starts?
Well, so far, Poland has accepted 672,000 refugees. This is over the past 6 days, and every day around 100,000 people crosses the border. So Poland is by far a country that is, the most affected by the refugee crisis, where, the majority of Ukrainians arrive. So more or less every day, the same number crosses the border. The thing is that in the first couple of days, the situation was very chaotic. The Polish authorities were not ready to accept so many people, so it took literally days to cross the border. Some people told me that it took them even 27 hours to cross the border. Right now, the situation has eased a little bit. It's much easier to cross the border right now. So now it's not as terrible as it was a couple of days ago. But still, around 100,000 people crosses the border every day.
That's a lot. And Poland, by far, taking many more refugees from Ukraine than neighboring countries. Why is that, do you think?
Well, one of the reasons is that Poland and Ukraine have a very long border. Secondly, for the past couple of days, Poland has been accepting loads of migrants from Ukraine, economic migrants. So at the moment, there are around 2 million Ukrainians on work visas in Poland. So the many Ukrainians fleeing the conflict have joined their families who have lived in Poland for the past couple of years. So in a way, this was the most logical solution for many Ukrainians. On top of that, Poland borders Germany and other countries where refugees are fleeing. So for many of them, this is just the most logical and the easiest way to get further to the West.
There have been reports that refugees fleeing from Ukraine who happen to be non-Ukrainian and maybe from different other parts of the world have been treated differently or not getting services as quickly or not getting services at all. What have you found?
Well, yes, that's absolutely true. Foreigners fleeing Ukraine have not been treated as well as Ukrainians. One of the reasons being that all the Ukrainians fleeing the conflict right now are women and children and elderly people. So in a way, the Ukrainian border guards, because the majority of these instances of discrimination and racism have been reported on the Ukrainian side of the border crossing. So many of the guards actually give priority to those women and children and elderly people fleeing conflict. Whereas the majority of foreigners fleeing are international students. Most of them are young. Many of them are men or women, who are who are not traveling with children, who are not traveling with old people. But this is not to say that racist incidents are not happening. They definitely do take place. Many people I spoke with reported that people of color have been pushed both by the Ukrainians and by the Ukrainian guards. It has been very difficult to control the situation at the border. So very often there were situations or there were instances where people were being pushed, where people were being shouted at. But we have to also remember that many of the foreigners who cross the border simply don't speak Ukrainian, so it's very, very difficult to communicate with the border guards. And this might also be one of the reasons why there have been, some misunderstandings. People I've spoken with reported that, for example, at one border crossing, Ukrainian border guards started a bonfire during the night because it was extremely cold outside, and allowed Ukrainian women and children to warm up at the bonfire, while foreigners were not allowed to at the bonfire with the Ukrainian refugees. So yes, these kind of examples of racism or discrimination definitely take place.
You interviewed a man from Afghanistan named Navid. And he had left Afghanistan. This was in 2007. Was living in the southern part of Ukraine, and has become a refugee himself, a kind of double refugee with his family.
Yep.
He considers, as you write, Ukraine is home. He plans on returning back. What did he tell you?
Well, he was devastated. He had to travel from Odessa, which is in the south. It's close to the Russian border, so it's not the safest area at the moment. So he fled with his whole family. That included 10 or 15 people, including his children and his wife. So he's just devastated, mostly because his city of Odessa, that he made his home many years ago, is being invaded by Russia. He says that he will not want to go back if Odessa falls under Russian control. So he's Afghan, but at the same time, he's also strongly supporting Ukraine, the Ukrainian army, and really hopes that the war will soon finish.
Is there any way to tell how the children are faring? And one can only imagine the trauma that they are experiencing, being forced from their homes, and in certain cases, walking for hours and hours on end out in the cold, as you described, the bitter cold, as you described. Is there any way to tell how these young people are dealing with this crisis?
Well, many people cross the border in cars. So very often, if there is a family with young children, people who are crossing the border with a car very often take them in, so that at least the kids are not waiting in the cold. And as I said, these kind of huge lines at the border have largely ended. I mean, still, people crossing the border need to wait for a couple of hours to cross it, but it's no longer over 20 hours as it was in the first days of the crisis.
And where do people go? I mean, I assume they have family, they have friends, and it sounds like the government is at least in the process of trying to set up some kind of services for these refugees. What can you tell us?
Many people go to reception centers that have been established at close to the border crossings in Poland. Some people are being picked up by their relatives or friends who come to the border, to take them further. Other people just use the services, the office of local Polish people who come to the border offering a place to stay. There are a number of groups on Facebook and other social media coordinating help for Ukrainians. So if someone needs a place to stay, there are, ways where, different organizations or individuals are trying to find a place to stay, for particular Ukrainian refugees. So there are loads and loads of different ways in which Ukrainians are being supported in this situation, but definitely this is not enough. And we are still waiting for the government to somehow try and coordinate all those efforts and bring some systemic solutions to the crisis.
And do you know why the government has been, you know, relatively slow to respond to this crisis?
Well, I wouldn't say that the government has been slow, because ever since the conflict began, the government opened the borders to anyone, even without documents, to enter Poland. So I don't think they have been slow. I think the problem is that Poland has never faced such a humanitarian crisis, and definitely, 100,000 people crossing every day into Poland. It's a huge number that even advanced countries that faced, humanitarian crises before would have a problem with. So I think the problem is that, it's time. It's a matter of time, and definitely NGOs and individuals are much quicker responding to these kind of crises than governmental institutions.
You have also written about Ukrainians who have been living in Poland are going back to Ukraine to fight against Russia. And tell us about some of the people that you interviewed. I mean, it seems that some actually had some military background, others, absolutely no military background. Tell us what they tell you about why they wanted to go back and fight.
Yes, I mean, this was actually very surprising, because when, at the beginning of the migration crisis, at the beginning when Ukrainians started coming to Poland, I was shocked to see that the queue of people going into Ukraine is actually quite large. Many people were just young boys or young men who wanted to support the struggle, to support the war. Many of them have been involved in fighting in the Donbas before, so during 2014 invasion, or we can say war with separatists from Donbas, depending on how we see this conflict. Sure. Others have no military experience whatsoever, but they still want to support the war effort somehow. I met a young man, a 35-year-old man, who is a sound director. He makes movies, but still he decided not to stay in the safety of the European Union, and he decided to go back home to see if he can be needed, if his efforts, if his skills could be used anyhow by the government at this critical moment. His girlfriend, who is a permanent makeup artist, also decided to go back. She said that she would really like to make herself useful, working as a nurse, for example, in one of the hospitals, or supporting the Ukrainian army in any other way. So you can see loads of motivation and loads of patriotism at the border. People are crossing into Ukraine, and then they don't even worry about their own safety. What they want is to support their country. I also met a very interesting...
Agnieszka, I hate to do this to you, only because we are out of time. They're playing my theme music here, and I really appreciate you joining us today in Radio Times, and thanks for your reporting as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Agnieszka Pikalicka-Lidziewska, joining us from the Polish-Ukrainian border. She's been covering the refugee crisis for Al Jazeera. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Russia's war against Ukraine has entered its second week, and the toll on the Ukrainian people has intensified with a growing humanitarian crisis, as we just heard, more indiscriminate bombings and attacks on civilian areas. In a worrisome turn, Russian forces attacked a nuclear power plant in southeast Ukraine early Friday morning, which is reportedly under Russian control. While Russian forces have advanced further into the country, Ukrainian forces have put up a strong resistance aided by civilians. Russian President Putin, who calls the war a, quote, special military operation, said the mission was going according to plan. Ukrainian President Zelensky held a press conference yesterday praising the Ukrainian people and had this message for Putin.
please leave our land. If you don't want to leave now, sit down at the table of negotiations. I am free. Sit down, but not 30 meters away, like with Macron or Scholz. I'm your neighbor. I don't need to be 30 meters away. I don't bite. I'm a normal guy. Sit down with me and talk. What are you afraid of? We are not threatening anyone. We're not terrorists. We don't rob banks. We don't capture other people's land.
That's translation by Agence France-Presse. Well, today in Radio Times, where does the war go from here? Are sanctions enough to stop Russian aggression? And how did this crisis in Europe happen? We have two guests who have joined us. Tom Nichols, professor at the U.S. Naval War College, also an adjunct professor at the U.S. Air Force School of Strategic Force Studies. He's a contributing writer at The Atlantic, and he joins us by Skype. Tom Nichols, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning. Thanks. Good to be with you.
Nice to have you with us. Also with us is Malcolm Nance. He's a counterterrorism expert, former military intelligence analyst, author of a forthcoming book, They Want to Kill Americans, The Malicious Terrorists and Deranged Ideology of the Trump Insurgency, which I don't think we'll have time to talk about today. Malcolm Nance, thanks for joining us on Radio Times as well.
My pleasure.
Let me begin with the significance of Russian forces taking by force this nuclear power plant in southeast Ukraine. And to you, Tom Nichols, this feels like a dangerous new stage in the war. What do you make of this? What's the message?
Well, I'm not sure that we know enough about the attack to say that it was an attack directly trying to destroy the plant. I think and I agree with, I guess this morning there were U.S. Defense Department briefers who said that, you know, they think that the goal was to capture the plant, to capture infrastructure. But the thing that's really dangerous here is that it shows that the Russians, as usual, as is their usual playbook, are incredibly reckless. They're willing to take incredibly stupid risks and do huge amounts of damage without regard for casualties or for the area they're in at any given time. And that's important to note here because this isn't Syria or Georgia. This is a country that Putin has said he has invaded because he considers it basically the same as Russia and the people in it to be the same as Russians. And yet he's running this war as if he's plowing into, increasingly he's starting to run this war as if he's plowing into Syria or Chechnya.
Well, Malcolm, let me pick up on what both Tom was saying, but also what President Zelensky said, sounding the alarm. And he said, this is referring to the nuclear power plant, if it blows, it won't just take Ukraine, but it will take Europe. How do you understand what's happening?
Well, I think I agree with Tom in that initially this started out as a as an attack on infrastructure. You have to understand how Russia has been playing these operations against civilians in the last few wars that they fought. First, I mean, Vladimir Putin got his bones coming up in Chechnya, becoming the prime minister of Russia, then winning the presidential election by literally leveling Chechnya. Leveling it. I mean, just going in, killing anyone who was there, destroying the insurgents that were operating out of Chechnya, then installing his own warlord, who he actually bought special forces from Chechnya up to Kyiv, on the attack on Kyiv. So, you know, it wasn't so bad in Georgia when he had the attacks on South Ossetia because the forces there were limited. And the same with Crimea in 2014, Donetsk and Luhansk. I was just at the battlefront in Donetsk and Luhansk just about 2 weeks ago, 1 week before the invasion started. And, you know, the Russians have been occupying that area for 8 years, and it's not just a rebel force, it's the Russian army who are back there. But this is an order of magnitude different. The type of attacks that they're carrying out on the urban areas now show that Putin is desperate, and he sees that his forces are losing. And he has authorized his commanders to use brute force. And sometimes combat commanders are idiots. Artillerymen are inaccurate. And when they say suppress the area around the power plant, these shells have a mind of their own. And they sometimes strike a power plant. But He's going for the infrastructure. He wants to deny it. If he has to, he'll turn off all the power.
Well, Tom, let me go back to you. And some have said this is a really historic blunder on the part of Putin. It is hard, as you have written, and it's, I think, anyone that cares about, you know, humanity. It's really so hard to watch on TV the destruction of a country and to feel so helpless on the sidelines to somehow intervene or to help the misery that we are watching. Is this a blunder on the part of Putin?
I think it's one of the greatest blunders in modern European history.
Really?
I really believe that this will leave, I mean, assuming that everybody comes out of this in one piece, without this escalating into a wider war, I think eventually it's not going to happen next week, and it's not going to happen in the next 6 months, but eventually the Russians are not going to be able to hold Ukraine, even if they can occupy it for the time being. Russia is isolated, and the sanctions that have been imposed are doing immense damage that are going to take years to unwind. The Ukrainian people, who once thought of the Russians as the Russians thought of them as something like family, now are going to hate the Russians for generations to come. Putin has made the greatest argument anyone can ever make for NATO. Which has found a new purpose. And I think it's kind of woken everybody up to why the United Nations and NATO and international institutions all exist. I mean, Putin, it is strange that strongmen and dictators always create the situation they fear the most around them. Hmm. And Putin ostensibly here went to war to, you know, secure his legacy and bring Ukraine under the Kremlin's control. And in fact, he, aside from the possibility that he's going to spark a much wider war here with the rest of the world, he's going to end up leaving Russia weaker, more isolated, his people poorer and angrier. I think this really is a blunder of incredibly historical levels. Certainly the biggest blunder, I think, in Europe, maybe since World War II.
Well, let me go back to you, Malcolm, and it's sort of unfair to ask you to get inside Putin's head, but I think we're all trying to figure out, you know, we know what his intentions are or were because he said them, but as both of you have said, I mean, what we're witnessing is the isolation of Russia, the sanctions, turning it into really a pariah country. Does Putin care about any of that, or is he more interested in his legacy?
It's fascinating because I wrote four books on the Trump Russia scandal, and two of them I did deep dives into Putin's KGB era days. And my last one, I went to his office in Dresden, where he was a junior KGB, a lower colonel is the position. And you could see there were about 10 officers in that building, and 9 of them were just Russians who were there to bide their time, drink beer in East Germany, and fill their ladders up with goods and go home. Vladimir Putin loved flipping spies. They said he was with the Stasi all the time. And when East Germany fell, the first thing he did was not go get luxury goods. He went and found the binder with everybody that they had turned into spies. It led me to believe that this is a man who revels in the game. He loves. It would be like making me president of the United States, right? Mm. Old spy. You just, you know, you don't want to do that. All they want to do is operations. So he now views this that he's managed to flip individual people, manipulate an American election, get his favorite person elected in several parts of the world, create an axis of autocracies. And I think that he believes himself that he can manipulate the world the way that he does individuals. He has made, as Tom says, the greatest blunder since, Stalin mass murdering his entire officers' corps pre-World War II. And that is that now he will be the downfall of Russia. They will not be having a Vladimirsburg built for him. There will be no statues for him. He will have no legacy except for the second greatest murderer since the end, the first greatest since the end of the Soviet Union. But I think in line with the admiration he has for Stalin.
Let me just quickly reintroduce both of you. That's Malcolm Nance. He's a counterterrorism expert, former military intelligence analyst. Tom Nichols is with us as well. He's a professor at the U.S. Naval War College, and we are talking about the Russian invasion of Ukraine, the war that's happening before our eyes in Ukraine. And you can join us. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Tom, let me go back to you and talk to you and talk to all of us really about President Zelensky of Ukraine. Much has been said about his early years as a TV celebrity and a comedian, and here he is, in staying in Ukraine. I guess when he could leave, determined to fight in the best way that he possibly can against this Russian incursion. He even says, I will sit down with Putin. And I also sense this extraordinary frustration on his part that he's essentially doing it alone.
Yeah, I mean, I was one of the people that when he was elected, I said, well, probably not a great idea to elect political novices. And I think when it came to the day-to-day running of the government, the poor guy was kind of, learning on the fly and a bit in over his head. But moments like this show us when ordinary people are made of extraordinary stuff. And the man has been extraordinary. I mean, he has been shown a bravery and a resilience and a willingness to defend his people that we just haven't seen from political leaders anywhere in a long time. And I'm sorry that we have to have this inspiring example from a man who is under siege in his own capital and dodging hit teams that are being sent to kill him from Russia. But, I understand his frustration, but I think that we have to resist being drawn into a wider war in Europe. And I say that, it's almost physically painful to say that as an American, because every fiber in me wants us to get in there and save him and his people. But I think that means a major war with Russia, and I think that should be, I'm not saying it'll never happen, but mm-hmm. I think it should be a last resort.
Well, Malcolm, do you think Putin wants a war with the United States?
No, I don't think he wants a war with the United States. I think he wants to put that last brick in the wall of the new Putin Iron Curtain, which is Ukraine. And this is good for your listeners to understand. I just spent a month there, and I was on the ground. I met every one of the senior combat commanders. I've met people in Zelensky's cabinet. The city of Kyiv until this week was absolutely a beautiful Western European city, more Teslas than I had seen in Hollywood, and that's saying something. And I went to every major city in that country except for Luhansk. And what I've discovered is that these people are very proud of their independence. Mm. And I'm going to tell you one thing. I am one of the few analysts that will say this. I think the Ukrainians can win this war.
Really?
Their guts, their determination. As one combat commander told me, the commander in charge of the battlefront in southeastern Ukraine, when the journalist kept asking him, well, what if they attack from the north? What if they attack from the south? He says, I don't care where they attack. I'll fight them. I've been fighting them for 8 years, and everybody here will fight them. And what you're seeing is you're seeing this national resolve that was not factored in Pentagon analysis. It was not factored in news media coverage. It was almost like they forgot there was a Ukrainian army. And, you hear people talk about making a pincer maneuver from the south to the north to cut off everything east of the Dnipro River. That's an area from New York City to Richmond, Virginia. The Russians just don't have the combat capacity to subjugate or subdue that country at all. This will, if they can get everything east of the Dnieper River and maybe parts of Kyiv, you're still going to have the longest insurgency since World War II. Well, the Nazis had to bring in 1.4 million people to subdue that country.
Picking up on that and going back to you, Tom, I don't know how this is going to end, but let's assume that Russia takes part or maybe all of Ukraine. And I think you referenced this earlier. How do you govern, you know, a country that you have partially destroyed, have forced a humanitarian crisis? As Malcolm says, these are proud people that don't want you on their soil, even if you claim that we're all brothers or sisters. I mean, how do you govern a country that probably would be filled with insurgents fighting against
you? You don't. You occupy it, and you resort to incredibly repressive measures until you're finally chased out. I mean, I think Malcolm's right about that. And I think part of the gigantic blunder that was involved here is that Putin somehow got it into his head, and, you know, Americans should always be a little humble about laughing at others about the "we'll be greeted as liberators" fantasy, but I think Putin, you know, like many large powers that have invaded smaller places, was told, "You'll be greeted as liberators. They will throw roses in the street. The Ukrainian army will lay down its weapons. The criminal Zelensky regime will, you know, flee the country, and, you know, a government of national salvation will take over, and we'll rewrite the Ukrainian constitution," and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, the idea that somehow the Ukrainians, that, you know, grandmothers would be standing in the street in front of Russian military vehicles, literally yelling at them, not, you know, with guns, but saying, "Why are you here? Go home. Your mothers miss you." You know, I think was something it hadn't occurred to him. Or if it had occurred to people around him, they were just too afraid to tell him. And so now he is going to occupy as much of that country as he can, and he is going to react to any challenge to Russian rule and occupation with absolute brutality. I think we haven't even begun to see the worst part of this, but in the end, I just don't think you're going to have some new regime that is a new, you know, I think what Putin was hoping for was a Russia, Belarus, Ukraine federation that then absorbs Moldova and becomes kind of a mini Soviet Union. But I just don't think any of that's going
to
happen.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. That's Tom Nichols, also with us, Malcolm Nance. And you can join us as well. We are talking about the war in Ukraine. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call 1-888-477-9499. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking about the news from Ukraine. It is dire as Russian troops take more territory, including a nuclear power plant, bomb civilian areas, and force more Ukrainians to flee the country. Again, talking with Malcolm Nance, counterterrorism expert, former military intelligence analyst, and Tom Nichols. He's a professor at the U.S. Naval War College. Let me pick up on a couple of comments here. And Malcolm, this is one from Adrian. Says, "What do your guests think about the Russian convoy's pause? I think the pause is deliberate to let Russian forces closing around Kiev to get closer and surround it. But what do you make of this pause? I think it's a 40-mile-long convoy of tanks and other military vehicles."
Yeah, it's a very, very large force. And this is a force, the 36th Combined Arms Army, that moved down from Belarus along three axes of attack. And I actually drove those routes in anticipation that they would be coming down them from Yeltsin in Belarus, and then through the Chernobyl Preserve, and then the eastern flank of Chernihiv on the other side of the Dnipro River. And it plays exactly as you see it now. That road, all of those roads, are thin, pocket rutted Philadelphia style secondary roads, right? Mm-hmm. I'm from Philly. I know these roads. And, you know, it was very difficult for us in an SUV with the military forces coming down there, the heavy equipment. It was going to slow down. But the key thing that we saw was at Borcha, Homamil, and a couple of other places, Borodyanka, they were bottlenecks that the slightest ambush is just going to stop that road. And we're now finding out that convoy, which I think was forced down. I don't think that it was part of their original operational plan. I think when the VDV, the airborne and the special forces, made their run into Kyiv and were slaughtered about 5 days ago, The Russian commander said, get everybody on the road. Let's do a mass into the city. It stopped. It stopped because anti-tank rockets are destroying the lead elements. Turkish-built drones that they have, Bayraktar, are carrying out pinpoint raids there to stop that convoy. And let me tell you, being on that road for 3 days, I was on that road for an hour and I hated it. So I can just imagine sitting there waiting for your doom, whether it's going to be ambushes out of the highways or MiG-29 airstrikes. But that is not a sign of progress in the war against Ukraine. It's a sign of a potential slaughter.
Well, picking up on several things, and Tom, going to you, and it seems looking at what's happening in Russia, but also what Putin has done in the past and his, you know, his various tactics and, I guess, arsenals. There's the potential of cyber attacks. He's used assassinations. He's done election meddling, as we know. He did the invasion of Crimea and now Ukraine. There's disinformation, and now we have a threat of a possible sort of nuclear confrontation. It seems he's got many tools at his disposal that he's willing to use.
And he's already using them. He has gone down the road on all this stuff over the past 5 or so, 10 years. That is, rather than keep saying, what is he going to do? We just have to deal with the fact that he is already doing all of these things, including making nuclear threats. But I will, you know, come back to the point I've been hammering for a few days here, which is he has really sunk himself into quicksand right now. And, it's tough not to react to some things. It's very difficult. I think, you know, for now, this is the old adage that your enemy is hurting himself more badly than you could at this point. But he's cyber attacks and targeted assassinations. And I think Zelensky has survived, I read this morning, something like 3 attacks in the past few days. I find it very interesting, I'm sure Malcolm does too, that there is at least rumors floating, and, you know, you can't take anything too much for granted in a war zone with every, you know, both combatants trying to spread stories. But I find it fascinating that apparently part of the way Zelensky was able to survive is that some of these teams are getting ratted out by sympathetic elements within Russian intelligence.
Oh, wow.
To the Ukrainians, which would make, you know, I don't think is impossible. I think there are probably a lot of people in Moscow and in both the Russian military and intelligence services who think this whole thing is a mad scheme. People need to brace themselves. This is happening, and it's going to get worse.
Let me read a tweet from Anonymous, and, you know, knowing that we have to take all this with a giant grain of salt, Malcolm, but it says here, mm-hmm. and this was, I think, yesterday or maybe the day on the 2nd of March, Russian FSB leaked information, alerted Ukraine to assassination plot against President Zelensky. Now we can expect an internal power struggle within the Kremlin to overthrow the Putin regime. In the meantime, let's continue with the attacks. What do you make of that?
You know, I'm not one to help the FSB.
Well, I was wondering. Okay. I remember interviewing you about the FSB. That's why I wanted to find out your response.
And in fact, it wouldn't be the FSB in this circumstance. It would be the SVR, the clandestine service of the Russian government, their version of the CIA. What I suspect is this. Because the battlefield is a funny place, and I've been on many, many battlefields. I've done 3 major invasions and 5 wars. It's likely that the Chechen special operations people that they captured at the Battle of Hostomel at the Antonov airport a few days ago saw these people prepping for their missions. Mm. And the Chechens are feared special forces troops, and the Ukrainians not only wiped them out, they killed their commanding general, who was one of Putin's, you know, favorite, you know, henchmen in terms of carrying out dirty operations. And what I suspect is the Zelensky government did a very good piece of counterintelligence. They leaked that it was the FSB.
Right.
So, you know, we often say in counterintelligence that pick your worst enemy and make it appear that they are your source. And then you can rid yourself of your worst enemy.
Let me go back to you, Tom. Yesterday, the White House announced sanctions against seven more Russian oligarchs and their families, including Putin's spokesman. And we'll impose, and I'm looking, this is a from CNN, imposing visa restrictions on 19 oligarchs and 47 members of their family and close associates. Are sanctions enough to derail Putin's plans for Ukraine?
No. And it's important to point out that some of these oligarchs are people Putin hates and couldn't really care less about. And if we decided to strip them of their money and their toys, you know, Putin will meet that with a shrug. Where the sanctions get really important, I think, is that, you know, people are understandably worried about how far he will go and how long he can stay in Ukraine. And sanctions really undermine his ability to do that. You know, we have basically shut down huge parts of the Russian economy, and that's really important. I mean, he cannot continue, you know, wars cost money. And the idea that somehow he can now, you know, really commit to this huge operation and occupation in Ukraine and then swing west and plow through Moldova and start banging, you know, kicking the door down in Lithuania, he's going to run out of money, and he's going to run out of patience on the home front with people that are now suffering. I mean, the oligarchs, you know, aggravating them could lead to some palace intrigues, I suppose, although I'm not all of that. I'm not that sanguine about the ability to overthrow Putin, but it's going to make people unhappy at home. And he's had, you can see it happening already. He is reaching for incredibly repressive measures at home because he's worried about the home front. So, you know, the sanctions as one of the many tools in our toolbox, we've talked about all the things that Putin can do. Well, we have, you know, we are not without resources ourselves. This really makes his life a lot more difficult, and it makes his ability to conduct war a lot more difficult.
Let me read an email from Celeste Malcolm. I'll toss it to you. She says, I agree with the guest that Russia has created a disaster that is thoroughly condemned by Europe and the U.S. However, the responses from China, Saudi Arabia, Iran, and African countries seem to show support or at least tolerance. I think we all make a mistake in thinking the whole world sees Russia as wrong. This may be a time for new alliances. That's a big question, but I'd be curious, Malcolm, your response.
Well, autocrats tend to support autocrats. I mean, Mussolini supported Hitler. Stalin supported Hitler for a time there, right? Tojo in Japan. This is not to be surprised. It was a historian who said that they could not believe that they were actually reliving 1939 in reverse. You had a dictator who was trying to, you know, seize lands of ethnic diaspora back from where they belong and then invaded another country. This is literally reverse, you know, Nazism in 1939. That being said, the Chinese have an advantage here. No matter how this plays out, if Russia collapses its economy, China will be there to pick it up. Hmm. If Ukraine is literally and utterly destroyed, China will be there to provide the materials to rebuild that country via Russia, because Russia won't be able to afford anything. If Russian money is seized all around the world and their $100 bills are sitting in suitcases, China will buy them for 10 cents on the dollar. They play long ball here, and they have the ability to eat out their economic lunch, Russia's economic lunch, and to benefit from all of these issues. I think they are going to be a little chastened about invading Taiwan now, because I think some of the Chinese, despite the fact they're a communist nation, actually like being in the capitalist world. And seeing Russia utterly crushed is not going to help them. But, you know, some sub-Saharan African countries, you know, Venezuela, you know, they're supporting where their money comes from and where the bribes are falling out. And that was Russia for a while. But I don't think it'll last long.
Tom, let me read a couple of emails related to you. One from Ronald, one from Jim. The threat of nuclear weapons was supposed to prevent war, but now we find that nuclear weapons are preventing NATO and the West from taking action to help Ukrainians. Please share your comments. And then a related question from Jim, just about the fact that we're dealing with, you know, with a country, Russia, that does have nuclear weapons. And we've talked on this before, but, you know, what are some of the options, I guess?
Well, I teach a course at Harvard Extension on the Cold War, in part because I've been so frustrated with how people have forgotten the Cold War experience and don't really understand it anymore. Nuclear weapons are not meant to prevent war. They're meant to prevent nuclear war. They are meant to deter other people with nuclear weapons from using nuclear weapons, and they're also meant to raise the cost of war in places that are of central importance to those who have them. So it's not, nuclear weapons are not magic. They didn't prevent war in Korea. They didn't prevent war in Vietnam. They didn't prevent wars in the Gulf. They didn't prevent the Falklands War. They didn't prevent war in Yugoslavia, in Syria. What they do is prevent major powers from going to war with each other and then threatening each other with nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. And I think where this comes into play in this conflict, you know, Ukraine, I feel like one of those heartless geostrategists that I actually don't very much admire sometimes when they talk this way, but Ukraine was not a member of NATO, neither was Georgia. There was no security guarantee to bring the U.S., you know, nuclear guarantee, the nuclear shield over Ukraine. Where that will matter is if Putin does threaten NATO countries. And I think Malcolm's right. He doesn't want a war with the United States, but I think he wishes that NATO would somehow get involved in this so he could turn it into a propaganda war with about, you know, brave Russians fighting NATO and then threaten us with nuclear weapons. The problem here is that Putin is unhinged, I think. He could threaten nuclear use simply because he's losing. There's 100 different ways he could do that. But I think people have to get it out of their minds that somehow it's inconceivable or something that he went to war in Ukraine. He's been going to war in other parts of the former Soviet Union, other newly independent states in the former Soviet area, and he did it in 2014. He put his nuclear forces on alert when he took Crimea. But that's not, nuclear weapons are not magical talismans. They don't prevent war. They are meant to deter attacks on nuclear states and their alliances.
And we're almost out of time here, Malcolm. And I heard the NATO General Secretary say that they believe that cluster bombs are being used. And picking up on, and you say they are, and picking up what Tom said, so we've got, you know, the potential of a cornered Putin with nuclear weapons and apparently using cluster bombs in 45 seconds. How does this end?
I am really a true believer that the Ukrainians can actually win the conventional war here if given the proper amount of resupply, given the proper weapons. And we're seeing that. Canada just sent, 12,000 anti-tank rockets. Germany sent 1,000 anti-tank rockets. Javelin missiles are coming in everywhere. Stinger missiles are coming in such numbers, almost 2,000 in the last week, that Russians will not be able to go at low altitude anywhere. We should sustain this so that that force can fight themselves. That's what the commander of the army, General Sersky, told me. I don't want your men. I want your weapons. Let's give it to them.
We got to leave it there. Malcolm Nance, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Pleasure.
And he is counterterrorism expert, former military intelligence analyst. Tom Nichols, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
My pleasure.
And he's a professor at the U.S. Naval War College and a contributing writer at The Atlantic. In fact, we posted one of his articles on our Facebook page you can read. To replay this hour, many more hours of Radio Times, go to whyy.org and look for Radio Times under programs. And you can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you for joining us.